Hey, it's Brandon. It's September. Do you know where your CME is? If you need continuing education to maintain your license or certification or just for funsies, think about Brian and my other project, the Intensive Care Academy. It's a video-based platform with a whole bunch ton of critical care topics for a variety of specialties. And we'll net you a big bucket of continuing education credit, which just about anybody can use. All you got to do is watch some videos and file for it. Go check it out if you haven't seen it. We like it a lot. ICU101.com. You'll get lots of videos. There's a couple of free podcast feeds. A lot of cool stuff over there. Otherwise, on to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Brian Bowling here with you, and with me as always is Brandon Odo.
Hola.
What's up? So, we thought we would talk about some toxicology stuff today. It's been a while since we've done this, but we've got an interesting case to discuss, and we thought we would get somebody who, you know, is marginally smarter than us about this. Brandon and I are minimally competent, as we've been discussing, at this sort of thing, but we figured we'd get an expert. So we got our old friend Jerry Snow. You might remember him. He was on the podcast a little while back. He is a medical toxicologist out west at Banner University Medical Center in Phoenix, where he's also associate professor of both emergency medicine and internal medicine at the University of Arizona, and our resident expert on all things tox. Welcome back, Jerry.
Great to be back.
All right, Jerry, we're going to talk about some iatrogenic drug toxicities, things that I think many people have a little bit of understanding of, but not a lot bit. So we're going to shine the bright light of knowledge on them. So let's say we have a 67-year-old male who turns up at the hospital. He has a history of a TBI, and he's had about one day of some behavioral changes until he was finally found unresponsive at home with generalized convulsions. They thought he probably had a seizure. So in the ED there, he's bolused with lorazepam. They intubate him for his mental status. They think this is status epilepticus. So he's loaded on levetiracetam and sent off to the neuro ICU. They do neuro things, including applying an EEG, and they decide for their initial sedation strategy, they'll put him on high-dose propofol. So he's put on 50 mics per kilo of that, and then titrating on the EEG to achieve burst suppression, he ends up on 80. That gets him nicely suppressed. He's on his levetiracetam. They let him chill. The next day, they try to wean the propofol, but he develops some more epileptiform discharges. They sprout up like mushrooms. So titrate it back up. They increase his dose, give it another 24 hours. The next day, same issue. They add on another agent, let's say lacosamide. So right about day three now, still on the propofol, and the wise APP, let's say, taking care of the patient, notices a rising anion gap on his daily labs. He also notices the urine has been very green looking. But he sends off a lactate. It's elevated at 4.1. And he scratches his grizzled chin and on rounds raises the question of whether this patient might have propofol infusion syndrome, sometimes called PRIS. So let's kind of sink into this topic a little bit. First of all, this is not something we see very often. What sort of people, what sort of patients develop this syndrome? You know, what are the risk factors?
Yeah, sure. So it's got a longer history than I think people realize. You know, first case report came out in 1990, did not get a lot of attention at that time, and it was really mostly reported in the pediatric population. And these were critically ill children, a lot of them with respiratory illnesses such as, you know, severe croup or pneumonia, asthma. And in a follow-up study in 92, that was the first time where it gathered more attention because of A case series where there were actually five children that died, all with a similar clinical picture, similar to what you described, but they all unfortunately developed a refractory bradycardia, leading to asystole, and they ended up dying. And then later, as years passed, like in the later 90s, it also started being reported in adults as well. Well, and what all these cases had in common is these were all patients that were on high doses, like greater than 4 mg/kg/hour, which is not typically how we think about it in the ICU, which comes out to about 67 mics per kilo per minute, which, you know, in my shop and everywhere that I've always practiced is typically how I think about propofol dosing is mics per kilo per minute. So definitely high, pretty high dose, similar to the case that you described as well. And so we know that people are on higher doses, people that are on prolonged perfusions, the reference range being around, you know, greater than 48 hours. Those that are critically ill. So I mentioned, you know, a severe respiratory illness, but patients with sepsis, burns, traumatic brain injuries, people in status are all at higher risk as well. And then patients that are on catecholamine infusions. So people that, like, for instance, that have sepsis and are going to be on multiple catecholamines to maintain their MAPs. And then people on systemic steroids as well. And then people that are malnourished, people that don't have an adequate carbohydrate reserve, because we know that in a stress state, you know, our body leans pretty heavily on carbohydrates as long as they're available.
So high doses, and you're right. I mean, some of the numbers you see are sort of hard to interpret. So you said about 67 mics per kilo per minute is the, I mean, presumably if you're at 65, you can't not get it. And if you're at 69, you're not going to for sure get it. But that's generally when it's been described.
Right. It's a continuum, right? There's been patients that have developed doses lower than that, and there's patients that obviously have tolerated doses in that range that don't necessarily get it.
And likewise, more than 48 hours or so. And again, not necessarily a clear cutoff, but less likely in someone who's on it for a very short time. You know, for example, maybe when it's used in the OR for anesthesia.
Right. I think they're less at risk. I wouldn't say the risk is zero. There are some cases reported in the medical literature within anesthesia. In fact, one of the most cited articles for propofol infusion syndrome actually comes from, you know, the anesthesia literature. So in really high doses where it's essentially being used for general anesthesia, for sedation, there have been some case reports, even when people are on it for just a few hours. Okay. But some of these initial case reports, people were on greater than 150 mics per kilo per minute. So like doses that I've never actually seen before.
Well, and that maybe kind of goes to why we don't see this much, because the majority of ICUs now will, I mean, we put a dose limit on all of our drips, but the typical kind of normal dose ranges for propofol in the ICU, I mean, in the adult world, you know, usually I see caps of like 40 or 50 mics per kilo per minute. So it would make sense that we generally fall, you know, fairly safely under that range. Again, nothing is impossible. But I would imagine if people were routinely titrating up to like 80 or 90, maybe this would be a more, not everyday event, but, you know, every month or every quarter or something.
Right. I think it would be something that we would see more frequently at those higher doses.
What is this? I mean, I don't know how deep we need to sink into Krebs cycles and stuff, but like what is the pathophysiology of this disease? Maybe that'll help people kind of wrap their head around what's going on.
Yeah. The best going hypothesis at this time is really comes down to mitochondrial dysfunction. And that's really twofold. It has to do with inhibition of the electron transport chain at complex 2 and 4, leading to, you know, trouble with an inhibition really of ATP production. So it's an energy production issue in combination with an inhibition of fatty acid metabolism as well. And those are the two main mechanisms that you'll see referenced.
So is this, I mean, to put it in context people are more familiar with, is this like an allergy in the sense that some people are predisposed to having a drug reaction to propofol, and if they are someone who has this, they potentially will always have it, and it's not necessarily, I mean, we talked that it is somewhat related to the dose, but it is sort of just an idiosyncratic reaction to the drug, or is this... I don't know. I'm trying to think of other analogies. Like, is this an inherent defect that a person has that you never discover until you're on a high dose of propofol? Oh, here's a good example. Malignant hyperthermia. Is it like this? Like no one just found it until you gave them the right stimulus?
Right. I don't think there's a clearly established link. We know some patients with underlying disorders, specifically people with like mitochondrial, especially any mitochondrial disorders that are undiagnosed, those people we know would be possibly predisposed to have propofol infusion syndrome, but there's no clear, you know, clear link like with malignant hyperthermia, for instance, or we've got genetic testing that we can do, you know, within a family, like, if, you know, if somebody has malignant hyperthermia in the operating room, then they know to have their family members get tested. And we know that that can be done. There's nothing to my knowledge to test for like propofol infusion.
Like a clear, you know, monogenetic risk. And then this is what your story is. And that's, it's clearly inherited and that sort of thing. It sounds correct. Like it's not particularly well understood.
That's probably also correct.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so how should we go about diagnosing this? And like a lot of uncommon things, probably the first step is just sort of when should you even consider it? We talked about who is at risk, so that's probably right. The first step. Thinking maybe someone who's on a lot of this drug, you know, tuck it in the corner of your head. But then what do you do then? Is there some screening we should do? Are there certain features that should make it jump out at us?
Yeah. So first and foremost, the patients that you're going to think firstly about are the patients that are, of course, on propofol at high doses or prolonged infusions or a combination of both. But anytime you have a patient in the ICU that's on propofol that starts developing an elevated lactate, an unexplained anhydrous metabolic acidosis, any cardiovascular dysfunction too, and that includes changes on the ECG. So you can see development of things like a right bundle branch block. You can see ST elevation in the precordial leads, like a Brugada type pattern. So even screening with an EKG can be helpful in that. You know, increases in the CK that you can't explain, leading to rhabdomyolysis, as well as the development of high triglycerides. Those are all things, but really the triad of, you know, elevated lactate, anhydrous metabolic acidosis, and cardiac dysfunction. That's where you should really consider this as a potential.
So this can be, I know there's a lot of potential confounders here, right? Because like this case we're talking about is a patient status epilepticus, right? That also raises your CK, that also raises your lactate, that also can lead to a lot of these things. So is there something, let's say we've got this guy and we go, he's been on propofol for a while and we check a CK and gosh, it's elevated and it's climbing and his lactate's elevated. Is there a way to distinguish, hey, this is Pris, not status, not
yeah. Is there whatever. An assay we can send to the Mayo yeah. Clinic that'll come back in 2 weeks?
Not that I'm aware of. Yeah, I mean it's going to be just a clinical diagnosis, and I think you would probably take steps to treat it as if it was. And you know, it's really a diagnosis more of exclusion, but I think it's something that if you were thinking about it, you know, you've got other options when it comes to sedation, and so it may be time just to stop the propofol and see if that helps.
So if we stop the propofol. Like, that's a good idea, right? So we think that's to stop the propofol. Things get better?
In some cases, they don't. I mean, some people will continue to kind of coast and, you know, not recover. And it goes initially, early on, especially the mortality rate was very, very high. Mm-hmm. I think things have gotten better with the early recognition, stopping propofol earlier, and just better supportive care in general. But I think switching over the sedation to something like midazolam or dexmedetomidine, and then, you know, maximizing supportive care, trying to reverse the acidosis. And there are definitely case reports of ECMO even being used to support these patients through the cardiac dysfunction, as well as renal replacement to help correct the acidosis as well.
Well, I bring this up because I know specifically in status patients, right? A lot of times we have these people on high doses of propofol to suppress them. Mm-hmm. And that may be, I don't know, the only thing, but maybe certainly something that we've got decent control of their seizures. And we say, okay, well, we got to stop this because we might have propofol infusion syndrome going on. And if we stop it, if I'm the neuro provider, now I have a question of, well, how long do I leave it off before I decide that it's not the problem and the propofol is helping my seizures, so I really want to turn it back on?
Yeah, I think that's a difficult question in the sense that, you know, some experts will say that if a person develops PRESS, if they think that they've actually truly had it, then some will advise probably not to rechallenge that patient. Because even going forward, even after they get through this critical illness, like later in life, they could still be predisposed.
Gotcha. So even if we think we're not 100% sure it was, we should just stop the propofol and, if at all possible, do something else.
If at all possible.
Put it in the chart as one of those, quote, allergies that, yeah, you know, maybe is a little unclear, but we thought maybe there was this reaction. And
right. Probably more of an adverse effect or, you know, an intolerance, but yeah.
So it's not like you can drop the dose down to a, quote, safe range and then maybe you'll be okay. I mean, maybe you would, but that would probably be a little bold.
Is it sort of like HIT in that regard, that once you're exposed, you got to stop it? And
I don't think it's as clear cut because I don't think we have the same level of evidence that we do for like HIT. You know, this is so much less common than, for instance, HIT, and we just don't have the medical literature and follow up. Like, I don't know if anybody, I've never found a paper where somebody studied that re-exposure and saw what the outcomes were. Like, did it reoccur? You know, I'm not aware of any publication out there that clearly demonstrate that it's, you know, safe or unsafe. I think it's more kind of expert opinion more than anything else.
Gotcha.
Thinking about the presentation, it sounds like the cardiac dysfunction can be a little nonspecific, like some sort of electrical changes might be common. Can you have changes in function too, like, you know, a newly reduced EF or something like that? Or usually it's just sort of in the realm of arrhythmias?
Yeah, so it can present in all those ways. It can be something pretty benign, as I mentioned earlier, like a right bundle branch block, which obviously is probably not going to cause much dysfunction, leading up all the way to refractory bradycardia, as well as the systole. You can see ventricular dysrhythmias, and you can definitely see, you know, decreased ejection fraction. So that would be something else that I would consider at the bedside. If I'm shutting the propofol off, I'm concerned about any type of dysfunction, maybe the patient's deteriorating, you know, having more vasopressor requirements, I would definitely throw at least a point of care ultrasound, if not get a formal echo on them to assess their, you know, their contractility and what their EF is.
So I guess something to kind of, you know, tuck in your head if you start seeing a new cardiac issue. Of course, there can be all kinds of causes for that. Maybe especially bradycardia, because that's a little less common and maybe a little more specific here. But otherwise, you know, thinking about your, whether it's a lactate or just an anion gap to start. And then I suppose you could routinely monitor the CK, or you can just check that sort of as needed. Of course, CK can be elevated in a lot of people, but if it's like rising on the third day of admission, that would be a little weird.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, you'll see some references out there that will say it, probably at least checking labs every other day, especially as you start reaching those higher doses. If you're reaching those higher doses, like greater than, you know, 50 mics per kilo per minute, getting into more of that 60, 70 range. You know, some people are going to say daily labs. Some people are going to say, you know, at least every other day, looking specifically again, lactate, CK, maybe grabbing an EKG every other day just to make sure. And then obviously if there's any clinical changes, right? If you're seeing something like worsening bradycardia, if you're seeing hypotension or anything else that would indicate to you, and obviously getting, like I said, getting a lactate and at least a BNP, if not a CNP.
So maybe consider this sort of like we do with triglycerides, right? When patients are on propofol, we check triglycerides like weekly, just to make sure that they're not getting too elevated.
Yeah, they may want to check them a little bit more frequently than that in a patient that's on the higher doses.
Sure.
You know, again, just to make sure that they're not, you know, steadily climbing or anything like that.
Well, I think we should distinguish some of the toxicities here, because I know some people will often monitor something like triglycerides, knowing that propofol can increase that. The other thing you'll see is, they threw in here for fun, you know, your urine can turn green. And I have heard people suggest that actually either of those things might be associated with a risk of PRIS, meaning like, say your triglycerides are getting really high, or your urine's changing color, maybe you're at more risk, which I never really thought was the case. Of course, high triglycerides can have other toxicities, like you'll get pancreatitis or something. And I suppose if you're having one complication of high doses of propofol, you probably have some association with more risk of PRIS because there was also a dose. But it's not like your triglycerides are 1,000, you're at higher risk of this disease because of that, right? They're just two separate things you get with a lot of propofol.
Correlation, not causation.
Yeah. Right. So there's, you know, there's maybe a slight association there. And then from everything that I've read, there's no close, you know, connection between the green color. People will, from the metabolite, their urine will turn green, and it by no means they have any other signs of PRIS necessarily.
All of this conversation happens on rounds, of course. And then, the team decides, all right, let's get out of this boat. We'll switch the patient over to a benzo, time-honored, and they go with a lorazepam infusion. So the nurse kind of cross-titrates the propofol over to that. They get off the prop, they end up on about 8 milligrams an hour of lorazepam, which gives them about the same electrical suppression. Next day, because of course all of our ICU decision-making is done in 24-hour cycles, the CK is trending down, the lactate comes down to 2-ish, everyone feels pretty good. But the next day, the lactate is trending up a little bit again. So our same clever APP who shaved his beard in the interim but is still clever sends off a serum osm and calculates the osmolar gap, and he notices that it's on the high side. So then he says on rounds, now I wonder about ethylene glycol toxicity from this lorazepam infusion. The patient just can't catch a break with iatrogenesis. So let's talk again here. Who gets this problem?
Well, you can see propylene glycol toxicity in anybody who's on a higher dose infusion of specifically lorazepam.
I'm sorry, I think I said ethylene. Yeah, thank you. Propylene glycol.
Yeah, propylene glycol.
These are really easy to mix up. I mean, you could easily mix up, you know, Miralax with a toxic diluent. But
so with propylene glycol, you know, patients that are on high dose benzodiazepine infusion, lorazepam specifically, because it has the highest quantity of propylene glycol in it. Diazepam as well as phenobarb also have propylene glycol, but not in the same amounts as lorazepam. So lorazepam is definitely the highest risk benzodiazepine infusion.
And we don't see a lot of diazepam drips, so just no. Practically speaking.
Sure. No, exactly. So it's probably, if you're gonna have a culprit causing this in the ICU, it's probably going to be lorazepam. The couple times that I've seen it in my career and came to the bedside to see the patient, it was lorazepam each and every time. For sure. But in patients with critical illness on high dose benzodiazepine, specifically lorazepam, and in class, you could see this, you know, historically with a really bad, back before we did more symptom triggered therapy with benzodiazepines, like a really bad alcohol withdrawal, where they would put people on continuous infusions, or like, again, status, like in this patient, would be another time that you would see high dose benzodiazepine infusions. But, you know, people with hepatic dysfunction, people with renal dysfunction are also going to be at higher risk of developing propylene glycol toxicity. But it's really, again, it's the high dose in combination with those prolonged infusions that really get most people into trouble.
So is there a dose range that we can tuck in our heads here, or is it a little less clear?
You know, historically, I always kind of, in my mind, think of anything about over 6 or 7 milligrams per hour. Some references will say like 0.1. On the more conservative side of things, you'll see some folks, you know, come to a lower dose, like 1 milligram per kilo per day. So I think it's kind of easier to go with like kind of a 0.1 range, but in adults, I'd say anything kind of over 6 milligrams an hour is where I would start to be more
concerned. Likewise for longer durations, not so much very short time.
Right. This is not something, even if people are getting frequent pushes, for instance, like you're getting a lot of, you know, IV, PRN, lorazepam, whether somebody was having, you know, seizures or whether somebody was getting treated for alcohol withdrawal, I would not expect them just from these push doses to get a significant, you know, elevated lactate, renal injury or anything like that.
So pretty much exclusively a phenomenon of infusions. And I mean, just to be clear here, this is not a toxicity from lorazepam. This is toxicity from the liquid that they dissolve it in. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. So since it's not water soluble, it has to be in a diluent, and that diluent is propylene glycol. So it's from propylene glycol. That's what gives you the osmolar gap, because it's osmolarly active, and then it's actually metabolized through alcohol dehydrogenase to lactate. And so that's where the elevated lactate comes from, and that's how you see the anti-gut metabolic acidosis from propylene glycol.
And so this functions very much like a toxic alcohol poisoning. I mean, we're not infusing people with like methanol here, but we're sort of getting to a similar place.
Right. It's a similar metabolism because, you know, chemically they are similar. They go through a, you know, alcohol dehydrogenase to produce their, you know, toxic metabolites, and they're both osmolarly active. So there's a lot of overlap. But I include this when I discuss toxic alcohols, I kind of lump this in typically to be discussed.
And then this is going to present in what way? Same kind of situation. I mean, it's something we just have to kind of think about, I guess, but then what's it going to look like clinically?
Yeah, so it can trip you up a little bit too, because as we mentioned earlier, with the same patient, you know, you can have elevated lactate for a lot of different reasons. Could be sepsis, could be, you know, sequela from, you know, having multiple seizures. The osmolar gap can be a little helpful if it's really elevated. You know, a lot of the time it can still be within that normal range. But as you started getting into, you know, an osmolar gap of 15, 20 plus, this should definitely be, you know, on your differential. And obviously, again, if somebody's on high dose, you know, benzodiazepine, specifically lorazepam for a prolonged period of time, and they're having hepatic or renal dysfunction, those are the patients that you should typically see this in.
And then we'll see a lactate that's elevated. We might see an osmolar gap that's elevated. Is there anything else that should occur, or is this really primarily sort of a lactic acidosis toxicity?
That's chiefly what you're gonna see. I mean, you can see some changes in mental status. You can see some things that kind of mimic sepsis too, but I mean, the patients can come a little obtunded as well.
Is there routine screening that we should be doing for someone who's on a drip like this? I mean, should we check their lactate every day? I mean, should we be following their osmolar gap, or is it, you know, uncommon enough that we can, I mean, if there's no real clinical change that's obvious, I don't know when I would be triggered to worry about it otherwise, you know?
Right. I would say if there's any type of clinical change, if, you know, most of these patients obviously on high dose infusions like this are going to be intubated. So you really can't rely on their mental status or probably further CNS depression. But, you know, if I had a patient, I'd probably, again, this is a patient that if I wasn't getting daily lactates, I'd probably grab a lactate at least every other day, as long as they were on, you know, 6, 8, 10 milligrams an hour of lorazepam, especially if they're having any organ dysfunction. Or they develop new, you know, while they're critically ill in the ICU, if they start to develop organ dysfunction, such as renal or hepatic dysfunction, this is where I probably would check a lactate daily. And if it starts to climb, you know, or you just notice the lactate's abnormal and you don't have a good other explanation for it, check an osm. And if you have an osm gap and the lactate's climbing, I would probably switch them over to something like midazolam, which is water soluble and doesn't have any propylene glycol in it.
And here again, there's no confirmatory test. I mean, I guess you could check a lorazepam level, but that's not the point. There's not like a propylene glycol level. I don't know, maybe there is, but that might not answer your question.
I'm going to say that you probably could get one, but it's going to be a send out, you know, for 99% of people listening to the podcast, it would be a send out test.
Maybe you can get one. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like also this, like propofol, this may be something that's not seen very much, partly just by changing our practices. I think there was an era when lorazepam was used more often in high-dose infusions, and perhaps because people are a little scared of this, because all these sort of idiosyncratic reactions are a little scary, because they can kind of just come out at you. I think a lot of places have gone more towards like midazolam as a benzo of choice if you're doing a benzo drip, which is far less common than it used to be. I mean, that has pros and cons. I mean, it may be shorter acting at first, it may accumulate more over time, but it avoids this whole issue, which sort of feels better. Brian, is that, you guys do more status than we do. Has that been your practice?
Yeah, pretty much the only drip I've used for anything like this benzo-wise is midaz.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think if you look back over the last 20 or 30 years, there's been such a shift in the focus too on adequate analgesia. And so with so many people being on, for instance, a fentanyl infusion, they don't tend to require as much sedation. Because when I was like a student and resident, you would still on occasion see. But then as that literature came out that showed, you know, with high-dose benzodiazepines, there seems to be more delirium. People tend to be on the vent for longer periods of time. Their length of stays are longer. So that's when I think we've seen over the last, you know, couple of decades, really more of a shift to a focus on analgesia and, you know, lower dose benzodiazepines and the use of propofol. More so in the ICU.
Yeah, really outside of status epilepticus, I can count like on two hands the number of times I've had a benzo drip on a patient in 10 years of practice, and 9 of those fingers were COVID related. Our ECMO patients, when they were our COVID patients, when they were on ECMO, propofol, they tended to just get chewed up in the ECMO circuit. And so we tended to use a lot of midazolam for those guys. But for the most part, it's pretty much status patients.
And Brian, even for status, are you guys doing a lot of propofol versus benzos?
Yeah, it kind of comes and goes. Some will do propofol and benzos. Some will do propofol. Some will do just high doses of benzos. But typically, you know, if we're getting into any kind of drip like that, we're kind of building on it, right? So we'll do a little bit of propofol and a little bit of benzo. And then probably we're getting around to barbiturates at some point. If we're on a propofol drip and a Versed drip, we're probably starting to talk about barbiturates as well.
Well, and it's something to probably remember, because both these toxicities we've talked about are pretty closely dose dependent. So using lower doses of multiple agents might make a ton of sense, even though in other circumstances you might say, well, they're both causing sedation, why complicate things? But there's sort of a different situation here. We're trying to stay under some toxic thresholds. So if that meant you had to do, you know, a tiny dose of 5 drips, that might make sense. It's not quite that bad, but okay, what else should we say about either of these toxicities? I mean, these are uncommon things, Jerry. So like, a lot of us are not thinking about this every day. A lot of us certainly don't have toxicology floating around to ask questions. But I feel like the key in many ways is knowing what it looks like so you can think about it. Because if you don't think about it, then the one that comes along, you'll miss entirely. And I mean, that could be a real problem. I have seen a renal failure that was ended up being permanent from propofol infusion. Not to say that if it was caught earlier, that could have been avoidable, but maybe. And you could certainly, like you said, I mean, mortality is real from both of these diseases. So I guess an index of suspicion is maybe the most important thing.
If you don't think about something, it's hard to make the diagnosis, you know, as you guys know. So I think just entertaining it as a possibility, especially as you get to those higher doses, and when a patient, you know, is going to be critically ill for several days, they're probably going to be on said infusion for multiple days in a row. I think it is worth entertaining, especially if there's any clinical change, but even monitoring that patient, you know, with, you know, frequent labs and, you know, like I said, maybe you don't, if there's no change, you probably don't need to get an EKG every day, but it's probably worth looking at one just to make sure there's no change in conduction. There's no, you know, change in the ST segments or anything like that. Because if you catch it that early, if they've only got a little bit of an acidosis developing, you know, some base excess or base deficit, and then, you know, you catch it and you stop it and you switch your sedation, that patient's probably going to have a good outcome. If you wait till they're developing multi-system organ failure and have, like, because in some of these case reports, you know, pHs were getting down into the, you know, under 7, you know, and then, you know, propofol was getting stopped. Those patients don't tend to have good outcomes, because if it's caught so late, even if you stop it, you know, they're already kind of on this downward spiral.
Well, I guess the one thing we didn't talk about was treatment of propylene glycol toxicity. Is this purely just a matter of stop the drug and they should get better? I mean, is there anything else you might need to do?
Yeah, for the vast majority of patients, that's probably going to be fine. If they were really acidotic, there's a couple things that I would consider. Is one, famotidine, since it blocks alcohol dehydrogenase, you can give them famotidine just like you would for methanol or ethylene glycol, and that will stop the production of lactate and the anti-GAP metabolic acidosis. And then if somebody was really sick, like this, for some reason it went for days, it wasn't caught, they were really acidotic, not just responding to like IV fluids and maybe some bicarb, not turning around. This is another situation where renal replacement will not only help fix the acidosis, it will also remove propylene glycol and its metabolites. So that's an option too. And you could do CRRT with that or HD, depending on, you know, how ill they were, and how stable they were and what they would tolerate.
Okay. So while the lorazepam you gave might, the effect might wear off in a matter of some hours, the propylene glycol may continue circulating for a little longer than that.
Yeah. You know, especially if they have, you know, end organ dysfunction, also people with, you know, hepatic dysfunction or renal dysfunction, especially in those, if they were an end stage renal disease patient, for instance, they don't have much, you know, they don't make urine or anything at all. They're going to have difficulty clearing the propylene glycol and the metabolites.
Sure. So like a dialysis or peri-dialysis patient who you've had on a drip like this, this might be a pretty good reason to think about dialyzing them early or sooner, mm-hmm. You know, even if maybe in somebody else who could pee, you might let them ride.
Absolutely.
All right. Anything else we should say about these topics? It's kind of short and sweet, I guess, but we're just kind of punching at the stuff that's really important.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've reached out you know, before we had this discussion today, to a couple of my ICU colleagues that have been doing this, you know, for 10 or 15 years. And it is such an uncommon, even talking to a few different providers, it was uncommon for anybody to say they'd had more than what they felt really confident was a couple cases. Like, you know, that would be typical. Like, oh, I've had one or two in the last 10 years. One I felt like really probably had it, like they had a lot of the things that we look for. You know, they were on high dose for a prolonged time. They had the acidosis. They had some cardiac dysfunction. Other cases were kind of soft, like, well, yeah, they had an acidosis. We stopped the propofol. We switched them. They got better. So maybe, you know, but it is so rare. I just think it's got to be on your radar. You know, if you're thinking about it, at least considering it, especially when patients have clinical changes or lab abnormalities that you can't really justify any other way, it may be time to make a change in the person's sedation just to take something off the table.
I guess the other thing we didn't ask was, you know, propofol infusion syndrome, there is at least some patient factor here. Is that the case for propylene glycol? I mean, can anyone get this at a high enough dose of lorazepam for long enough? Or are some people far more susceptible? Meaning, can you just bring down your drip and continue it? Is this something I should put on their allergy list and they should never have it again? That sort of thing?
Yeah, no, I will say that I think the evidence here is a little better in the sense that I wouldn't call it an allergy or an intolerance, really. I think it's really just an adverse effect from getting too much drug, which you could say for any drug, right? So like if you give somebody too much fentanyl, you know, they're going to get sleepy or stop breathing. If you give somebody any sedative, if you give somebody phenobarb, they're going to get sedated. For instance,
and or I know if this you give someone different. Too much propofol, their triglycerides will go up, but you wouldn't per se call that a drug reaction.
Right. And you wouldn't say make it a hard contraindication. So if somebody was on 10 milligrams per, you know, an hour of lorazepam and, you know, later for whatever reason they needed to be on at 5, I would not be concerned that they're going to develop problems, especially if they had, you know, normal organ function. But any of us at a high enough dose.
Right. That doesn't rule out that some people might have more susceptibility than others. You said some of the factors like their renal and hepatic function. And maybe there are some other factors that some people just are more susceptible.
More prone.
But that doesn't mean that, you know, if you wave the drug in their general direction, they're going to break out in lactic acidosis or whatever.
Yeah, correct. I mean, I'm not aware of any patient-specific you know, factors that we can test for or that have ever been, you know, quoted in the literature to say that this population of patients clearly shouldn't get lorazepam.
So why don't we wrap things up there? I'm so glad to have you back and talking about this. We'll remind everyone, this is just some general educational content, no specific advice for you. And we're just sharing our own thoughts, not representing our own institutions here. But we'd love to talk to you next time, and we'll see you then.